CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning, just after 7 o'clock. It is time for us to check in with Canthan Pillay in the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. This is your opportunity once a week to catch up with all the current affairs stories and hopefully have some opinion thrown in as well. If you have stuff that you want us to address, you can always message us 0797482090. And we're going to be joined also by Jamie Mighty, who is a law graduate from the University of the Witwatersrand, who is currently furthering his studies at Wits Business School by studying business admin. And he's been a part of the show before. He's going to join us in just a little while to share some of his opinions. Good morning, Canthan. How are you?
I understand there was some type of sporting event that happened over the weekend.
Just a little one that kind of got the country a little excited and positive for the first time in ages. You know, we've forgotten what it feels like to win. We've forgotten what it feels like to be able to celebrate our country, because all we've done in 9-10 years is been embarrassed and ashamed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually thoroughly enjoying just kind of basking in this feeling. It won't last, but for now it's a really good place to be. I just have this this sense that, you know, people are smiling for the first time pretty much in 9 years, so, you know,
well, I'll tell you who's smiling quite a lot, because this is an ugly headline I saw this morning, and I hate to put a dampener on your otherwise ebullient mood, but there are people at the airport who were there to welcome the Springboks yesterday who were robbing other people at the airport who were there to welcome the Springboks.
Yes, yesterday. But that's, you know, South African innovation. You know, the hustle is always part of it. And
that's great.
This happens around the world, you know, but I certainly don't want to single us out and say, look how terrible we are. No. If anything, I would say that our thieves are far less competent than those that we find in other parts of the world.
That's quite something to be accused of, is being less competent thieves.
Yeah.
Is that the most insulting thing you can say? Because that's quite something. All right, let's get stuck into a few of the stories while we're waiting for Jamie, who's on his way. There's obviously a bit of traffic this morning, as there is every day in Johannesburg.
Oh, you know, people must stop using traffic as an excuse in Johannesburg. Just get out of bed earlier. Really? I mean, this whole idea that, you know, traffic is going to be a problem when they pitch up, look, you know, trying their best to look all harried. Oh, you know, it was the traffic this morning. Actually, just get the flippin' hell out of bed early
discipline.
In the morning.
Discipline.
Yeah.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about our government and their... They want to make NHI a reality, which means that everybody in the country will get access to basic health insurance. Of course, it's a pipe dream, because it'll cost more than the government have in terms of money. Even the Treasury recently tabled a prospective accounting of what that might cost, and it's unaffordable in every which way. And they've also done trials in, among other places, the Northern Cape, all of which have been dismal and abysmal. Yet government will continue to push the idea that the state is better at managing your health and your money than anyone else. Despite every bit of evidence to the contrary, your chances of survival at a state hospital are far lower than at any other institution. And our government are piss poor at administering anything. Yet they continue to push this narrative.
I think that right now they've actually committed to pushing this narrative because, like the ANC, they had just express this idea that they're going to go down this path. But then if you read the finance minister's medium-term budget speech, he made it very clear that the money for pulling this together was just not going to be made available.
But they're going to carry on talking about it.
They're going to carry on talking about it.
Now,
they'll carry on spending money on pilot projects and the like. But for now, I'm just actually taking the view that, you know, thank goodness for the fact that Zuma has screwed up the economy as badly as he has, because it means that
there's no money
in the short term for it. And this was what Margaret Thatcher said, remember? You know, eventually.
The problem with socialism is you eventually run out of other people's money.
Yes, absolutely. Very well said.
Now,
can you do Churchill as well?
I need a drink. If someone gets me a whiskey, I could probably do it. So here's why I brought that up, because it's kind of old news. But at the beginning of the year, the Department of Higher Education and Training said it had been leveraging the 57 billion rand that they get from the national budget every year to help the poorest university students gain access to higher education at no direct or immediate cost to them. So in other words, free education. The department came under scrutiny since former President Jacob Zuma announced in December 2017 that poor and middle-class households will be given access to free higher education about 2 months before he resigned to make way for Cyril and left the problem in Cyril's lap. In part, the commitment to free higher education is a response to pressure put on government by student movements who gain momentum from their call to end the escalation of university fees and is serving as something of a hot potato to the Ramaphosa administration. So is it possible, if we can't do free healthcare, to do free education? I mean, in a word.
Let me put it this way, all right? I think it's actually important that if we have a scenario, like athletes, for example, if you have someone who actually has the capacity to be a really sterling ambassador for the country, I think it's actually worth the country investing money in ensuring that that person gets to the top.
Mm.
So let's take a similar view in terms of academics.
Right.
If you have someone who is obviously quite brilliant and has performed well academically, I think that that person is deserving of actually receiving financial assistance to get to the top. And I think that that should be self-evident. But the whole idea that poverty in of itself should immediately be a passport to getting someone else's money handed to you, I have a problem with that. So I'll use myself as an example because, you know, I was lucky enough to end up going to an Ivy League university, as in Princeton. And the way in which you got into Princeton is you first had to get in on the basis of academic excellence.
Right.
Once you got in on academic excellence, they then assessed your ability to pay. And then, of course, my coming as a South African in the 80s, and, you know, obviously if one considered things like Rand dollar exchange rate and all of those things, I was clearly not able to afford what was at the time, I think $25,000 a year was the fee for Princeton. And so I got 100% scholarship. I mean, they basically covered everything. But it was on the basis of first you get in, then we assess your ability to pay. And if you're not able to pay, then we will actually make up the difference from our financial aid. But of course, the difference in terms of the way in which the Ivy League universities run is they have a massive endowment, which the alumni have contributed to over the years. I still send donations off to Princeton every year when they have what's called annual giving. I think my class raised something like $156 million this year.
Wow.
And that's just my class.
That's phenomenal. But then that's also kind of why they treat their students so well, because they're hoping that when the students do make money later on, they'll give back.
Yes.
So it's
a virtuous cycle.
Virtuous cycle. It feeds itself.
Yes, which is entirely different from the scenario that we have right now, which says if you're poor and you keep flunking out of classes, we're still going to prop you up in perpetuity.
And it's unsustainable. And studying things that don't really have the ability to generate any kind of serious income after the degree is earned.
Well, yeah, any sort of income, let alone serious income.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you shouldn't ever have anyone paying for your degree in philosophy.
True, because, you know, philosophy is something one learns. Hmm. And the books are freely available. Just go to Project Gutenberg and download them for yourself.
Right.
Watch the YouTube videos that explain the Socratic dialogues. And yeah, you're a free way.
Now, there's an interesting story that's been happening, a sideshow, really, that the BLF have been part of for the longest time. They're no more. Andile Ngritama's retirement plan has been officially deregistered, leaving 0.07% of registered voters politically homeless. The Electoral Court's Monday ruling that the BLF could not appeal its deregistration as a party because it still excluded membership on the basis of race lowered the curtain on one of South Africa's most morbidly fascinating political sideshows. This a story from Times Live.
I take the view that they should not have deregistered the BLF.
And, really?
And at the time that these guys were taken to the IEC, and I don't remember who it was. Was it AfriForum who took them to?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but
on the basis that AfriForum really wanted to join the BLF.
Look, my view, you know, in terms of I have a view in terms of freedom of association.
Mm-hmm.
And my view is that, you know, people should feel free to be able to associate with themselves and get together. It's an entirely different thing if you have a scenario like if you're applying for a job.
Yes.
Where, you know, there's a clear-cut case of discrimination there.
So, in other words, if you are a horrible racist person with horrible racist ideas,
you should
many
be able
people,
to get together with other horrible racist
people.
Particularly so that, you know, I know where you happen to be sitting at any given stage.
And avoid that place.
And, well, avoid that place, or more importantly, you know, plant bugs into the place so that, because you are going to be technologically incompetent, you know, so that I can keep track of what you're doing and ensure that when you try coming after me or mine, that I've actually been forewarned of it. But seriously, I think that if you and a group of other bigots or perverts or whatever want to get together and associate exclusively with each other, well, by all means, go ahead and do it. I think that the likes of the BLF, really, they should be tested at the ballot box. And I, you know, frankly believe that the market that they are catering to is already overserviced by the EFF. It's just that the EFF are smart enough to not put in place legal restrictions on who can join them.
Well, that also brings up the issue which I had an argument with someone about this morning. The idea that Vicky Momberg can be called a convicted racist. Racism, again, is not a crime.
Oh, God, you know, so I mean, my frustration with the sheer idiocy of people who write headlines on an ongoing basis, and trust me, the number of times per day that I turned around and yell about cliches and...
So people who think I'm an idiot might just think I'm being an idiot, but you explain why it's wrong to say convicted racist in a headline, because the crime is not racism.
Well, she wasn't convicted of racism. She was convicted of crimen injuria.
Thank you very much.
You know, the technical term is criminal defamation.
Right.
And it's an interesting charge, criminal defamation, because many years ago when I was... running ETV News, I'll be talking close on 20 years ago, I had Newsweek publish a rather scurrilous article about me, mm-hmm. which, you know, in typical Newsweek style is has a glimmer of truth in there, but then is laden with adjectives that... but they called me the Prince of Darkness, among other things, which was... something that, I thanked Martin Wells for that years after. But basically what I did was I had a conversation with Trevor Manuel just shortly before that article was published. Trevor Manuel had come into the ETV studios for an interview, and there had been a cover of Newsweek which had Trevor Manuel and Maria Ramos in a bathtub. And...
This was before their relationship was public.
Exactly. Yeah. And at that point, so I asked Trevor Manuel, you know, why don't you sue these guys? And he says, no, Martin Wells is very clever, because what he does is he launches a CC, publishes an edition of Newsweek through that CC, and then winds up the CC. So if we go and sue, there's nothing left to sue. I said, oh, really? That's interesting. So at the time that Martin Wells then went after me, I didn't bother suing because I had no interest in getting money out of them. I just went down to the Cape Town police station and filed a charge of crimen injuria, criminal defamation.
But you can do that if you're an individual.
Absolutely.
The difficulty here in this situation...
Well, if the individual in this case, the Vicky Momberg case, was the police officer, then yes, very much so.
But it wasn't.
It wasn't, yes. And which again means that that judgment was pretty much flawed. But the interesting thing, by the way, just in terms of that crime and injury
just
case...
Because we have to be like children about this and explain everything. This does not mean that in any way we think that Vicky Momberg is not a horrendous person or that she shouldn't in some way be held responsible for her actions. But what she did was not being a criminal racist. She was accused of this crimen injuria, which we also think is probably a fallacious charge, and the court didn't do its job. I mean, it was the Equality Court or something?
No, I don't think it was. Well, I can't remember. I don't remember the exact
details. The fact is...
But look, the fact of the matter is that you file these charges because your dignity has been impaired.
Mm-hmm. But this is a very subjective thing.
Yes.
So it's very hard to ascertain where exactly a law has been broken. Anyway, the point is the headline's wrong.
The headline is wrong, correct. You know, is she a racist? Well, probably.
Yes.
But that's not what she's convicted of.
Yeah, there we go. All right. The Gwede Mantashe story, you spoke about Trevor and Maria Ramos all those years ago. But the Gwede Mantashe story is a whole different thing. He is clearly very embarrassed because he's not dealing with this well. I don't understand with politicians, like the best way to just make it go away and for people to just get on with their lives is to go, yes, Sure, I'm having an affair. You're going to have to deal with it personally anyway. Don't tell me he goes home to his wife and she's thrilled. He's already got the punishment of having to be this guy who's supposedly having an affair in the eyes of his wife. Surely to just say to the journalist...
Not to throw shade, but, you know, I think Guede Matasha's wife is heaving a sigh of relief that he's not coming home tonight. What do you think?
Now, isn't that deserving of a charge of criminaneuria?
No, it's speaking truth to power.
All right, so what do you reckon should be made out of this? Because at the same time, I mean, I don't know how much of a reputation this guy has.
Look, I have a theory, okay? And my theory is that Guede Mantashe did, in fact, pay the journalists to plant the story.
Oh.
Because think of it as a marketing exercise.
Oh.
All right? Suddenly you want to set this reputation out there that, you know, Guede is the man. What? He's a tiger, right?
Right. Is this like old school masculinity where you prove your ability to be prosperous by bedding all these women?
Absolutely. Okay. So in the old days, you could do it in public. I mean, JFK did it all the time, you know, the secret entrance into the White House.
Sure.
And, you know, Marilyn Monroe's tales. But today you can't do that because it's politically incorrect. So what you do...
But you also can't hide things because of social media anymore.
Yeah, but social media doesn't really get facts right. So, you know, let's park that for a second. But you take a case like... just imagine, you get a couple of corrupt journalists and pay them to plant a fake story that you happen to be in this really torrid relationship. And suddenly, hey, presto, you know, it's marketing. And there's a whole lot of blessees out there who say,
of course.
I wonder if Uncle Greasy is, you know, going to cast a glance in my direction and, you know, hopefully some money comes with it. Well, that's my theory.
Well, I don't think it's a bad theory. But Sanef, apparently, we're told that he was retracting a claim that he made about the two journalists. He says now that he did not give the reporters 70,000 rand to make a story involving a younger woman go away. According to Stephen Grotes, from a political point of view, what is more concerning is that he did something that created a situation in which he was desperate to hide certain info. This surely means he's capable of reckless behavior and potentially a counterintelligence threat. Considering how, I mean, that's an interesting take on the whole thing, is that now, as Minister of Energy, he's a counterintelligence threat.
Oh, God, all of our.
I think that the ANC is so porous at this point.
Siyabonga Gcwele, whose wife was.
She was a convicted drug smuggler.
Yes, and he was Minister of Intelligence. Oh,
I think if you have 50 Rand in your wallet, you can get something out of someone in the ANC. It's that easy. I mean, really, it can't be much harder than that. All right, so Jamie Mighty's here. How are you, dude?
I'm very good. How are you doing?
Nice to see you, man.
Pleasure to see you.
You made it through the traffic. Well, you've missed out on our conversation about...
You see, the left wing is always late. The right wing pitches up.
Well, that's about personality. That's why some people do vote right and left. Right wing people believe in conscientiousness and order. Left-wing people believe in freedom and slightly more lax control.
No, they don't believe in freedom because they generally believe in communism, which is the antithesis.
Stop it. There's no room in your mind for any opposition.
Yes, there is. Right. You know, I mean, I think Jeremy Corbyn's kind of hot. I could totally do it.
Really? You think Jeremy
Corbyn, of all people?
Well, Corbyn's all they've got in the UK.
You see, the left is eating itself. He's already dissing Corbyn.
No, I just don't think he's a good... depiction of a rational left, and I think that's sometimes the problem with these conversations.
There's a rational left, please.
There is.
Expound upon this.
So the thing is, everybody assumes that like left people don't look at numbers, they don't understand the dynamics or the bottom line. And I think with Corbyn, if you look at his challenge, also is that Boris Johnson has stolen a lot of their manifesto. You know, hospitals, schools, etc., etc. So now he has to go further to the left because the conservatives are no longer conservative because Boris is not really a traditional conservative. You know, he wants to spend money, he wants to extend the debt, and he wants to take economically risky decisions. You know, so that's not really the traditional path of conservatism. Mm-hmm. But if you look at someone like Corbyn, he goes a little bit too far. But I also think that people should not measure the left based on the far left dude that they can find, you know. So if you think of far left as being Andile Mqitama, you know, that is not an accurate reflection.
No, he's of right-wing. Thinking on, he's absolutely right-wing. He's positively
to
fascist.
A degree, you know. I mean, I think you know,
but isn't it like a horseshoe? The further you go to the extreme left or the extreme right, the closer you actually are at the ends of the horseshoe.
True. I would agree with that. Yeah. But I think we need to look at the, I'm going to call it the rational left, just for want of a better phrasing. But there are a lot of people who actually understand. For instance, if we're looking at this whole rugby nonsense, there's people who understand the points around trying to bring people together, mm-hmm. around a common identity, around a shared identity, mm-hmm. whilst also understanding that more needs to be done actually to address inequality, etc. You know, not everyone is taking the extremist position.
Let's just for the moment, because it's the first time I've actually sat and chatted to Jamie. And I mean, I've followed some of the stuff that you've said. This obsession with equality. First of all, I think a little bit of scientific research would do people an enormous amount of good, because they would see for the first time that there's such a thing as the Pareto principle, which is that everything in the universe is distributed unequally, from mass to wealth to water to electricity to just about everything is distributed unequally at a fairly constant ratio of about 80 to 20.
Mm.
Right? So equality is a pipe dream, and utopianism is for people who don't mind counting the corpses all the way to Stalin and Mao and the rest of them. But I think that the purpose of life might actually be to be as unequal as possible to everyone else.
Well, you know what I think? I think that when you're trying to order a society, what you want to do is give everyone the fairest chance at winning the game.
But I have a principal problem with you even saying to order society.
Well, I mean, that's what governments do.
But where does this authority derive from?
So, I mean, whether you're looking at it from social contract theory or whether you're looking at it from veil of ignorance, it's unfortunate because...
How about individual sovereignty?
Well, I mean, all of these social contracts do recognize individual sovereignty. But what you're trying to do is to say, look, if you think about it as a game, which it obviously isn't, to say, if we're all going to play the game of Monopoly, should someone start with $1,000 and someone else start with $20? If we do that, the game is not fun for the guy with $20. If someone starts owning off Clifton and owning the other hotel, there's no way you have a chance of actually being able to play game.
So you would like the state to come in and hand out things?
No. I think what the state's
that's the
role...
That's the only alternative.
The state's role, and you see this like in the more, let's call it the countries with less inequality. So I don't think the American model is the best. But if we give everyone equality of opportunity, and
absolutely.
We can truly say that whatever you have in life is because of the decisions you made and maybe the strategic mistakes you made and maybe the fact that you were less lucky than others, then that's fine. You know, if you end up somewhere in the middle of the pack, purely because that's just how the cookie crumbles, that's fair. If you end up in the middle because, or at the bottom because the system was designed in a way or wasn't redesigned after being designed in a way that was designed to exclude you. So if you look at, for instance, the role of government in education, mm-hmm. you'll find that this government inherited Bantu education and they kept it, right? And that's one of the criticisms that I have of the system, in that they had an obligation to make sure that everybody had the same opportunities as a Kingsmead girl, but, as
okay,
a
so you bring
Rodin
up,
boy.
You bring up
or,
education. I think education's a great place to start this. And Canton, we are going off on a tangent here, and we'll get back to the current affairs.
I've been sitting with amusement because, you know, once again, the problem as soon as you get into these leftist diatribes is that we never end up talking about how one ends up paying for all of these dreams.
I want to take it back a little bit further. So sometimes in education, it's a software problem. In other words, that you didn't get the education.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's a hardware problem.
Yeah.
Like there are different levels of academic excellence at the outset for everybody. And there are talented people who grew up with nothing and who, as Canton and I were discussing before you arrived, should be given, for example, in the government's attempt at delivering free higher education to people, those people should be given an opportunity to excel because they are gifted in some way.
Absolutely.
And there are some people who are completely ungifted. I don't know what to call those people because ungifted sounds unkind. But those people should not be propped up for year after year of failure in a humanities degree at university.
For sure. So, but if you look at our system right now, we have a country with 3% of people with university degrees. If we're using the Pareto principle, we should have 20, right? Mm. We should have 20% of our workforce being a high skills workforce, and then the rest of that workforce being maybe, let's call it medium skills or hand skills, sure, right? And everyone...
But shoulda, coulda, woulda, we can't even employ 29% of our people.
But if you had a system where we had actually solved some of these problems, because some of the barriers to our economic growth is our skills base. We can't participate in the tech economy at a high level because we don't have those kind of tech skills, for instance.
But how do we solve that then? I mean, let's be theoretical for a moment. Let's be completely idealistic, yeah, and imagine we can design something approximating utopia. How would it look to you?
So if we want to be competitive in the short term, which is why I'm so disappointed with some of the priorities that Cyril Ramaphosa has chosen, we would have to really rejig our education system. We would have to say, listen, let's find a building that has been built already that maybe is derelict or whatever. Let's refurbish this building. Let's put all of our top learners here. Let's get some guys who understand coding. Let's go poach them at Silicon Valley. And within 3 years, let's make this be our first crop of coders, of real people with real skills to create tech solutions for the African economy.
No, this is utter rubbish. We've already...
How is it utter rubbish?
It's utter rubbish because we don't need to bring people in from Silicon Valley. We've got these people already sitting in Stellenbosch. Look, trust me.
It's fine. So we'll get them from Stellenbosch.
We've got them in Stellenbosch. But the fundamental problem, it's this absurd notion that you can take a person off the streets and teach them how to code.
But that's not without, who I'm talking about.
No, without them knowing the basics of mathematics.
We don't even have literacy
it goes
numerous.
Back to mathematics.
That's not what I'm talking about, guys. I'm talking about right now, in the system, we have enough students who actually have the grasp of mathematics and science and physics, etc. But they're scattered all over the country, right? So why don't we create real centers of excellence? I mean, this is what I would have done if I was Cyril. I would have said, listen, I want 3 schools. I want them to be mega schools, which can house up to 5,000 students. Get me all the smart kids. All of the smart kids, get them for me, put them in the school. Let's give them a 3-year program where we focus on science, maths, computer science as well, and then see what we can do with this new workforce. You know, whether we send them to MIT and bring them back or
but
we teach them
locally.
This
should be a private sector initiative. This shouldn't be a public. The government can't do this. We've seen that they're hopeless at administering anything.
But this is the new guy, right? He's supposed to have the stuff.
No, but he's not the guy to look to. The private sector could do this. If you put a profit initiative in there and you deregulated and made education something. Look at how well Advitech have done. Look at how well all these independent schools do. How? Because they have less government interference, not more.
You know, I always struggle to pronounce Advitech. Is it Advitech?
I think it's
because of the V.
I don't know.
But what when I listened to him speak at one of the seminars that I attended, I actually thought. And by the way, the one of the old CEOs, I don't know if he's still current. He was a former ANC guy, you know, and then he moved to private sector. So I was actually thinking, if I was Cyril,
well, all the cleverest ANC people left politics.
If I was Cyril, I would go and hire this guy and make him the Minister of Education.
But
I would not have kept
Angie. He wouldn't want to work in the government.
Why
because
not?
Suddenly he has to deal with unions and bureaucracy and bullshit from above, from politicians.
But I would have given him the cut
no
blanche.
One competent.
Guys, can I just bring us back on
yeah,
track?
Yeah, bring us back on track.
On.
Let's
okay,
go
Okay, I'm
back.
Bringing you back on track at this level, okay? And the flaw in terms of Mighty Jamie's pipe dream. 127,000.
Yeah.
197 are the number of people who passed mathematics in matric 2 years ago.
120,000.
127,000 out of 197. Out of half a million people who effectively ended up sitting matric exams.
20% maybe.
Well, maybe 20% of that, but that's passing maths, okay?
Yeah.
Now, in order for you to be a coder, you actually need to be looking at maths that's, you know, kind of in at least in the sort of 60% pass range, as opposed to the pass mark of 30%, which is where we're currently pegging ourselves. So now, if you then split it down further into the number of people who actually pass mathematics with a competent enough score to be able to actually learn how to code. Because listen, coding ultimately is all about mathematical
logic. Of course.
And if that is the type of raw material that you need to work with, where you are literally talking about tens of thousands of people every year out of a country of 55 million, you don't have a hope in hell of implementing this coding nirvana that we're talking about. Trust me, the raw material there is just not available.
So you know, like I coach in township schools and stuff like that, and I'll tell you one of the things is that we look at the output, right? And not always look at the quality of the raw material. So we say, look, these kids didn't get the grades, therefore they're bad. And the reality is, if you go onto the ground, a lot of kids, they have the brilliance. They've been failed by the teachers. This is why I was saying that you need to have almost centers of excellence, because that's how you usurp the problems of a culture of poor quality teaching in our schools.
Yeah, but we're posting all of this at the door of education institutions and teachers.
Oprah Winfrey School already does that.
But it's only one school, right? And that was the challenge of that school.
What about parents? What about society at large? There are a lot of factors that come into play here.
I agree. You know,
and some of those things can really damage kids at an early age. If you don't have, for example, the stimulation you need at age 3 or 4, and let's say your parents are both working or dead, and you have no ability to find yourself the resources to even have a meal before you go to school, your chances of success are absolutely abysmal.
It's true. What you're saying, all of those factors you've pointed out are true. So let's use a case study. When LeBron James opened that school for excellence that he did in the States, I don't know where it's located. Mm-hmm. One of the things they did was they found all the kids that they could, but they also made sure that they had a program to take care of the domestic situation, you know,
right,
so that they had support downstream as well. So all I'm saying is...
And all of this is fine in a situation where you have capitalism and there are people with spare money and good intentions. But in a country like ours where there is no capital running around because business has been decimated, unions still make the shots with things like Eskom, how are you ever going to find the money to even begin to deal with the domestic situation,
so,
let alone
so, I mean, in response to this particular question, the man has been saying that he got $366 billion, right?
He's lying.
Well,
I know
that there's a bit of fudging of the numbers, but I do think that Cyril has enough social capital. I mean, he was able to raise close to $1 billion for his own campaign.
Yeah.
He has enough social capital to go to the corporate community, which does have a lot of money in reserves. You know, they're very nervous about whether or not to invest in South Africa.
Right.
And it makes sense if there's a corrupt government. But I do think that an education initiative is something that no one would be opposed to. I've never met a person who said that they're opposed to educating brilliant young people to improve
the economy.
No, but
you see, again, the flaw in the logic. The reason why corporates don't invest in the economy right now is not because of corrupt governments. You have to understand that some of the best money to be made on this continent is made under corrupt governments. What corporates actually thrive on is certainty. So if you can put a percentage in terms of what the cost of corruption is going to be and still generate a decent return on investment, people will go ahead and invest. It is the norm north of the Limpopo. The problem that we've got right now is in the South African context, if you were to take R1 billion and invest it in a business, and with the myriad of regulation that we have, you had end up with an effective return on investment of about 4%, whereas you can stick it into a government bond and end up getting more than double that amount of money. Mm. Why the hell would you want to start a business? It really is as simple as the numbers.
Look, I think you make a strong case around government regulation being a little bit too much, you know, and some of it is in terms of the labor sector. Some of it stems from the history of South Africa, you know, in terms of trying to make sure that there's a floor for decency, you know.
You can't make sure of stuff like that. It goes back to the thing about trying to enforce equality, which takes us back to our conversation.
I think it cuts both ways with labor, you know what I mean? But I do actually think that it's something that needs to be revisited, because if you have so many people who are working below the minimum wage anyway for pragmatic reasons, but they're no longer on the system, then your labor controls have no longer become effective.
Let me ask you both, because this is something a lot of people are fascinated by. What is the size of the informal economy in South Africa? Does anybody have any grasp on this? Because the cash economy that's going on, which is something which is beyond government, Stats SA can't tell us. We can only thumbsuck at this. Do you have any idea, and what do you think the potential of that economy might be?
Well, I have no idea, but I know that Thabo Mbeki tried to put a feel on it to get a grasp of how big it was, etc. But it is vast, you know, and the informal economy is very difficult to measure.
You see, immediately when we use words like vast, he can say vast, I can say small.
How small would you say?
Neither of us are able to prove it. If I turn around and say that the size of the informal economy right now happens to be R5 per day for every school kid. And you have no way of disproving what
I'm saying. But I mean, if we're talking about in terms of the percentage of people in the country who may not be informal employment, but are economically active in this secondary market, what number or what percentage would you say
it is? I'm saying it's irrelevant. And the reason why it's irrelevant is because it actually doesn't address critical issues in terms of how we build the overall size of the economy, in terms of things that we need to do around infrastructure, around things that we need to do to grow industry. Because the problem with the informal economy is that it basically ends up being ring-fenced into particular communities. So it isn't money that actually transcends the borders of those particular communities. So yes, it the size of it really doesn't matter. It's just money that kind of keeps circulating within a particular area. And by the way, I've just had a correction from someone who says that, in fact, it was not AfriForum who took on the BLF. It was the Freedom Front Plus. Thank you for pointing that out. Yes, we are sticklers.
Yeah, Jamie, you missed out on that one too. Yeah. Are we happy or sad about the BLF being deregistered as a political party? Canton thinks it's a mistake, that we should always have space for people, even if they have egregious and terrible opinions, to be able to coalesce around each other in some kind of organization. The danger, obviously, being that if we don't allow that, it drives it underground. Or worse, that these people end up jumping from other party to other party, spreading their destruction. Yeah. So what's your feeling?
So I think that the instruction should rather have been for them to remove the one line that seemed to be quite objectionable, that it's a party for blacks only. Or to rephrase it in maybe a politically black, because the definition of black, it's quite an academic debate that exists there. You know, there's, if you're a black African, you're black.
It's very uninteresting. Exactly. It sounds like the kind of debate for Wurtz people used to
have.
Well, I
mean, but it does happen, and you'll be amazed how much time it occupies.
Oh yeah,
but
in
what
universities
I'm saying is,
and nowhere else.
But what I mean, also in bars and stuff. You know, where the politics manifests.
I really
itself.
Do. These are the kind of people you call your friends. I mean, you must have
the most boring Friday night. I have interesting debates with a variety of people. But my point is really this. I think that rather than removing the BLF, what should have been done is like an instruction to say, look, this phrase is in violation of our constitutional norms. Can you remove it? And then we can work with your political party. I don't think that the BLF has as much traction as people think it does.
That's almost a bit worse, if you ask me.
Do you think so?
Yeah, because it's significantly worse. You're teaching people how to think.
But it's an offensive
thought
phrase.
Police is what you're doing.
I don't care if people are offensive to me. You see, that's the difference.
Okay, so here's my problem. Yeah. The Freedom Front, nobody in the Freedom Front wants to join the BLF.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is just, it's hypocrisy of a kind. The AfriForum, I keep trying to say that, but it's the Vryheidsfront Plus don't want to join the BLF. So why do they care if the BLF want to keep white people out?
It's the principle.
No, it's a stupid principle. And it's pointless and it's political posturing. And you and I and Canton know it.
But you know the thing is,
it's nonsense. And nobody's gained anything from the BLF being deregistered. Nobody cares.
It's like banning a flag, you know? I mean,
it's stupid. So there's two different things here, right? When you're dealing with like legislative stuff, sometimes you have to make a rule about the actual constitution of a party, et cetera, because downstream, you don't know the impact of that particular thing. So the fact that they had that line in their constitution saying
Do you think if the Weimar Republic had outlawed the Nazis early enough, we wouldn't have had Hitler?
So I think it's an interesting hypothetical, but I do think you could have dealt with Hitler differently. I do think that too many people got caught up in the sensation of his economic analysis, and they were looking for a strong man to speak against, you know, Europe, and they ignored all of his anti-Semitism, which is also why I'm not a fan of Jeremy Corbyn, for instance, because a lot of people ignore his anti-Semitism because they like his his left politics. Mm. So I think that with Mkhitama, for instance, there is no real need to fear Mkhitama because the people have given a way in on his political party. They said they're not interested.
Yeah.
He had less than 15,000 votes. So it's a very small enclave of political thinking in South Africa. However, I do think that if you're the electoral commission, if you're electoral courts, you do need to make a ruling about a particular phrasing, because it could happen in future that a big political party could then come up with the same phrasing. What happens if the let's say the Democratic Alliance then says, listen, we are fully committing to a white project from now on. This is now a party exclusively for whites. I mean, it's never going to happen, but if there is a legislative possibility that now, through your jurisprudence, you allow the BLF to make that rule, what happens if there's another political party that comes up? And it's difficult to envision these things.
What do you think of that?
Look, I think the entire idea around protecting the rights of individuals means ultimately that you give them the right to freedom of association. It really is that simple.
Even if their association is morally revolting.
I find most people morally revolting, frankly.
But you get the point, right? There's no way the court was going to...
That's not a horrendous argument. Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't disagree with you in principle, but I'm also saying, in principle, who cares? Like, the point that you made earlier was almost more relevant to me, that actually, Andile is a non-entity, and so is the BLF. They've got, like, 500 people who are actually registered members. You would struggle to fill even a small auditorium.
Which is why I wouldn't have deregistered them, right? I would have said to them,
yeah, let them carry on.
By the standards of our constitution, by our legislative framework, this particular sentence is not allowed. However you conduct yourselves as a political party, obviously whites are not welcome in the BLF. You know, you don't need a sentence in a constitution to be clear.
I do think we've become so obsessed with this idea that someone can decide to exclude us and that it's the most wounded thing that can ever happen to us. Like, there are lots of things that I know I can't join, and I'm actually okay with that.
Yeah, you can't join the Black Lawyers Association.
I can't join the Black Management Forum. There are lots of things that I can't join. And frankly, I don't care, although I see from your point of view how that could be egregious to someone, because in this country, we have a history of people being excluded from some pretty important things that you might want to be a member of, like, for example, the economy. I mean, just saying. So I do get it.
And I mean, so...
Well, I'm pretty sure the Black Lawyers Association would let you join, Gareth, if you were a lawyer.
No, I don't think they'd let him join if he was a lawyer.
No, I think they would. I think that no white person, or I should say non-black person, has actually applied to join the Black Lawyers Association. But, knowing lots of people who are in the Black Lawyers Association, I don't see any reason why they would turn down that person.
Listen, I also think there are organizations like the BLF, which are really just a collection of losers. Like, who would want to be a part of something like that, whether they're black or white?
Well, Andile, clearly.
Well, Andile lost the political plot a while ago, and that's the unfortunate thing. And I think his demise really arose from his strategic mistake. Sometimes you're going to lose in a conference. You don't leave the party, you know, because he was an MP. He had a voice.
This is in the EFF.
This is in the EFF.
But he was pretty much thrown out.
But he chose to go, right? Yeah. Because no one was saying that he's no longer going to be an MP. Nobody was saying that he can no longer be a voice, you know, because his voice, when, let's call it tethered to some form of disciplinary structure, it can actually provide a robust critique of the South African position.
Sure.
The problem is you shouldn't let Andile just be a force unto himself, because he goes to the extremes as evidence.
But then so what? Let's let people destroy themselves with their own words. Same goes for Vicky Momberg.
True.
These people, the medicine is the cure. You know, and the medicine is what society will deliver to you because you're an idiot.
True. All I'm saying is, like, just as a strategic assessment, his strategic mistake in terms of the game of politics, you know, if you're aspiring to go up the ranks and become a dominant player.
Maybe his strategic mistake is to be born an idiot.
No, he's not an idiot. He's an extremist. And, you know,
I never called him an idiot. I just posed a hypothetical question. Just putting this out there.
He's a guy who's been seduced by extremism.
All right, what do we think of Tito at the moment? I want to hear your thoughts on Tito, Jamie.
Well, you know, I think, so we're going to separate.
Especially in the light of the medium-term budget, so that we're not just doing a character.
Okay. So it's now true that there are tigers in Africa.
Yes, I'm going to stay away from the tiger conversation.
Right.
So I really think that Tito he's towing the austerity line. And one of the interventions that he mentioned that I thought was a difficult one was that the way he wants to save the money that everyone wants him to save is by reducing the size of the civil service and that wage bill. And for me, that felt like not the right place to begin in terms of, like, cutting the fat, so to speak.
Yeah, everyone says that, but it's more than a third of the national budget. It's the biggest thing we need to cut.
I understand, but you know that...
Why do you not want him to start there?
One, because we already know from the Auditor General's report that there's a lot of irregular spending happening in South Africa, in all of these municipalities. Mm. So if he had said, I'm bringing across an aggressive task team to stop the leakage, because we have money, the money just trickles out into people's Lamborghinis.
But why would it be a problem for him to be cutting the size of the civil service to you.
So
that's
so,
a separate argument that he wants to stop the leaking. Everybody's for that.
But that's where I would have actually, you know, I would have focused on something that's pragmatic, that's not going to have a negative impact.
So what's the negative impact of cutting the bureaucracy?
So you cut the bureaucracy is one phrase, right? It's not like it gets better as it gets smaller, right? It just means, because we already know there's a problem of efficiency.
It does get better because we save money.
No. I mean, I'm talking about efficiency. It's not like we're going to get more output just because we've reduced, the number of people.
Might.
I doubt it. But here's the harm.
We might at less cost.
If you take the people out, right, what's going to happen is that they're not going to be able to get new jobs in this particular economy, right? This is pragmatic.
Well, the only reason they have jobs in the first place is because they were government cronies to start off with.
So are you saying maybe you're for sheltered employment?
I think in our context, we have to be very careful. Now, I actually think that there's a big problem in our civil service. And part of the problem is the brilliant young people who get hired, they don't actually get elevated to the management levels where they need to be to execute the kind of things we'd like to see. They just get stuck in the middle, right? And so you have the political cronies running the management of our municipalities and our departments. But the young people who apply and believe in civil service, they get stuck in the middle. And you meet a lot of them and they're frustrated. Some of them leave banks to go work for the civil sector, and they go back to the banks.
So the political class remain the problem.
True. But now, if we remove all of these people from the working sector.
Who's we?
I'm talking about the country.
The country is the government. And
the
government.
Government
is that sector that is the problem.
True. I'm not disagreeing with that. If you remove them, they're unemployed now. They're not likely to get re-employed. And then they're going to become a tax burden, some of them, because now they need to be on welfare. So now what you've done is you've decreased the amount of spending capacity that you have. And the presumption is that all of the money that we save will actually be redeployed to other areas. But we're talking about the government here. What are the odds that money that they save in one department will actually make it anywhere it was supposed to go? Even under Tito, if he actually came and said, I'm going to clean up my financial management first, because that would be a positive sign to the markets.
Of course, I don't think anyone disagrees. I think that's a very valid point. But to be in favor of the sheltered employment seems to me to be an argument against your own position.
Look, austerity is not the best solution when you're in times of economic difficulty. I mean, if you look at the two case studies, the dominant one,
Greece.
You can look at Greece, but you can also look at the UK response versus America when the market collapsed. So America was able to rebound their economy quite fast because they took, it was unfair for the people. They took the people's money.
They bailed out the banks.
But what did that do? It resuscitated their financial system and they were back chugging. And now their unemployment is 3.4 last time I checked, right? 3.4%. But the UK chose the austerity path and they were virtually unable to grow for the years that they were sticking to austerity. It's only after they abandoned austerity that they were able to re-stimulate the economy. So I think there's a lot of evidence
there are
now.
So many untruths in there that I'm not even going to to dissect.
I'm giving a high-level analysis.
Okay,
what's untrue there?
Let's just focus on the US, the US example.
Right, a couple of fundamental...
So it is, and I'm going to paraphrase you here for a second if you don't mind, Jamie. It is Jamie's allegation that the only reason that the U.S. economy survived and started booming afterwards was because they were prepared to bail out the banks and spend government money on private business.
The single biggest reason why the U.S. economy is booming is exactly the reason that I, in terms of my newspaper article that I sent you this week, Gareth, you probably haven't had a chance to take a look at it yet.
I'm sorry.
But one of the things that I was proposing was that the best thing that Tito can do right now to kickstart the economy between now and when next our ratings comes up is to slash taxes for the middle classes, which is,
but that's also stimulus,
which
right?
And the point is that the stimulus that went into the U.S. was not the fact that the banks were bailed out, but the fact that Trump had this really sweeping tax cuts, and more to the point, because of the things like earned income tax credits, which ultimately ends up being kind of along the lines of a negative income tax, which means that if you are at a lower...
If you don't mind my interrupting, I think that would solve Jamie's problem around government not being able to do anything when it saves money. Because if you don't give them the money in the first place by being a taxpayer and withholding that money or being given a tax break, then that money is in the economy.
That's money, yeah. money that but, you but, then end up but spending.
Kenton is also yeah. fast forwarding a little bit, because here's the thing, is like we had Obama for 8 years in that period, right? There was a bailout. There were like freezing of interest rates, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Trump did that whole, tax cut, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these things are versions of stimulus, you know, and a lot of people do say that Trump's regime or presidency rather benefited from Obama's interventions. So it is clear there was some kind of stimulus to the American economy.
It's very hard to separate these things. It's like trying to
but it's versions of stimulus is
sure,
my point.
Of course.
And the UK didn't adopt a stimulus approach. They wanted to tighten the belt, cut the fat, trim the fat, and it wasn't effective. But you can even look at countries like Greece, where they were forced to trim the fat, and they're still struggling to revitalize their economy to this day. So my point fundamentally is that
Greece's problem is that exactly the problem that we've got, that they've got a bloated civil service which sheltered employment,
and they were forced to trim that. That was the analysis that I don't know, what is it? Is it the bears? Who's negative? Is it the bears or the bulls?
The bears.
The bears are negative. So the economic bears came and said, you guys have got a bloated civil service. You need to trim it. You need to trim your debt, et cetera, et cetera. And Greece complied, but they're still feeling the economic pain. And guess what happened? No money flowed in the more they trimmed the fat, et cetera. Sometimes
that's
you need
because
to...
because no one in Greece does pay tax.
True. That's also part of it. No, but I'm talking about from outside, et cetera.
Yeah.
So the idea that if you... ipso facto just adopt an austerity package, you are then necessarily going to grow your economy because you've impressed a mythical international community, isn't necessarily true, which is why I think we need to be looking at areas where we can boost our performance, not necessarily areas where we're just going to cut stuff and hope for the best. Because cutting that civil service number size, it does mean, in places where you have to give people their packages, etc., we're going to lose a lot of money up front, but there are people who are going to be unemployed.
Yeah,
but we
only have to give them packages because of our labor laws, which again is something we need to reform.
But we do have to if he wants to cut it.
Well, I want to focus on Canton's article because I did a quick breeze through it. Sorry, Canton, I should have paid more attention when you sent it to me earlier this week. But you're saying cut taxes on the middle class. This is obviously a pipe dream. It's something that the ANC can't afford to do. Taxes already are down on the estimates of every previous
year. I'm saying it's something that they can't afford not to do, because simply the best way to stimulate the economy and to actually boost growth is to put disposable income into the hands of people who are likely to dispose of it. So, I mean, Gareth, for example, all right, if you gave yourself R1 million, or if you gave me R1 million, I literally would not know what to do with it. Because I've no interest in changing my car, because I'm very happy with driving my 9-year-old clunker. I have no interest in getting a bigger house, because I'm very comfortable living in the place where I've lived for the past 14 years. Do I want a bigger TV set? No, I don't. I've got one that I've had for the past...
Who watches TV?
Yeah, well, exactly.
True.
Do I need a new computer? No, this MacBook that I've now had for 6 years still, works absolutely fine. But you take the average middle class person and you give money directly back to them, the first thing that they're going to do is they're going to spend it. They will do things like they will immediately upgrade their TV, for example. They'll spend money on improving their homes. But all of this has the knock-on effect, because as soon as they start spending that money, that then further kicks off demand in the economy, which then ends up with more money, correspondingly flowing back in terms of taxes. And it actually works.
The whole idea is that
the upper end of the market, just leave the tax rate where it is, but give that break to the middle class. Because remember, the upper end of the market, who contributes the single biggest chunk of our income, by the way, the upper end of the market, there are something like 500,000 taxpayers who contribute $256 billion in tax.
Right.
Okay. There's about $249 billion that gets contributed then by the middle class. And that collectively is more than 50% of all the tax that government actually raises. So I'm saying leave the $256 billion on the rich, for want of a better word, on the 500,000 people who pay that tax. But then, at the same time, reduce the income tax that's being paid by the middle class, which is roughly 7 million people, put that money into their pockets, and hey presto, You know, suddenly you'll see an economic boom. It's exactly what was done by Trevor Manuel, by the way. He consistently cut taxes during the Mbeki era, and the knock-on effect was people spent it. Yeah.
So look, I think the premise of the argument is fine, that we need to do something for the middle so that they can actually get economically active again. And then, you know, that will trickle down downwards and then boost our growth. I think, though, what I would say is that there are two things that are driving expenses for middle class people. In fact, maybe three. One is insurance for all of the stuff that could get stolen in this country. The costs of that are quite prohibitive, and they take away a lot of disposable income.
Sure.
The second is the medical aid.
Look at how much money the insurance companies have made.
Exactly. The medical aid is another thing that is just killing everybody, because nobody wants to take the risk of dying in a public hospital.
I don't
want to
take
a lot of money.
I certainly don't want to take the risk of letting government decide that for me.
True. True. So that's the second thing.
I'd rather pay it. I mean, as horrible as it is to have to pay those exorbitant medical aid rates, they are a safer bet than letting, who's the new minister, Zweli Mkhize, decide for us what's going to happen to me if I'm sick.
So there's a lot of people share that concern. And then the third one is that the cost of housing in the big cities has become so prohibitive. And if you look at the average middle class...
But housing prices are dropping.
Are they, though? Because the rent prices are not dropping.
20 years, nothing but a bear market in housing, which means prices are definitely going backwards.
People are not buying houses as much in the, let's call it the middle.
Sure,
they're renting,
yeah.
And those rentals are not going down, you know. People have to live further and further away if they want to get a decent rent, or if they have to pay the premium.
Yeah.
But I do think that government has not, for instance, there's the area where Maboneng is located.
Yeah.
That's a good location for redevelopment. And I think that you can make affordable middle class
private
housing.
Sector.
Private sector.
Look, I don't think that the private sector by itself is enough.
Maboneng is a classic example of sector by
Maboneng
itself.
Maboneng is just a slice of that
Do
whole
you know
pizza.
What the CBD was like before private sector started
True,
to
but what I'm
invest
saying is,
and develop? It government, when government was left to its own devices, turned the place into Mogadishu.
But guys, do you know what? There's nothing intrinsic to a government, any government. It's not like by virtue of becoming government, like if you become a government official tomorrow, you're not going to become incompetent tomorrow. You know, it's not like there's a
it's a precondition for getting into government.
They were incompetent before, precisely.
No, but what I'm saying is that we have incompetent people in some positions where we don't want them. However, some of the interventions are, you know, they're doable. And people have done affordable housing from a state. I mean, they've done this in the UK many times.
Jamie, it always astonishes me that people are prepared to give over the decision over important things in their lives to government, particularly in a country like ours, where we have seen nothing but evidence of government's inability to administer these things. How on earth would it ever be a good idea to let those people who have clearly fucked up everything they've touched be the ones to decide on your, my, or Canton's future?
Look, the thing is, the challenge is, we are not choosing the right HR for the task.
So it's a people thing.
So I think it's we share this obligation.
This
responsibility.
This is the old left argument about socialism has not been done right yet.
Because I haven't
we'll
done
get it right.
No. That's not what I'm saying necessarily. Because even when you look at collective private sector interventions, if the whole private sector comes together to do a particular project, it's a form of social, work. And some people could say that is a socialist corporate agenda, you know, because they have socialized as a group to do a particular thing. So what I'm trying to put across is I don't necessarily put aside good ideas because the people who are currently in position to execute them have no appetite to do so. What I do think is that if we correctly identify the problems...
If you give these incompetent people a good idea, they will invariably turn it into a bad result.
It's possible.
And that can be extremely costly, not only in terms of lives and in terms of economic problems that will ensue, but also in the long term for the health of the nation.
Look, you're not wrong when you say that. My rejoinder would be that government actually can do stuff if the people stay close to that particular intervention. So, for instance, because everyone watches the money...
I don't know. I think the people of this country, we all tend to abdicate our responsibilities too easily to government.
And maybe we should, that should be the conversation.
Most people are looking for a father figure to do all this stuff for them because it's too hard. They're prepared for the government to intervene and you know, raise their children for them and see to education for them and see to healthcare for them. There's no sense of personal responsibility going on in this country. So when you say the people must stay close to government on a project, give me an example. There isn't one.
I mean, they do stay close.
There is not one.
So I
can't, one example.
So I'm trying to think of a good example for you.
You
but
will be here all day.
No. I have one. I just can't remember the name of the project. So if you followed, there was a case in Piri around water distribution, and the people of Piri wanted to get a better water distribution, and the city was pushing back, and they actually stayed. They had a community group that they formed to deal with this water issue. The ultimate result
where
of that
is this?
I can't remember, but I can't remember the name of the project. Just Google it real quick. Piri Water Soweto. And it actually went to the highest courts. And as a result of that, the water distribution across the country was improved, you know, because they had to make sure that there was in townships water, at least a tap in the yard, and in rural areas, a tap within a certain vicinity. I can't remember the name of the particular group.
This was a service delivery protest.
It was a service delivery, not protest as such, but movement. But okay. Another example is the treatment action campaign, of where communities were actually able, because a lot of people give credit to Jacob Zuma for this stuff, and not to the treatment
you
action
mean
campaign.
Like with the ARV provision of ARVs, yeah.
Because it was... the treatment action campaign over a series of years.
But you're arguing against your own position here as well, because the whole reason we had to have a treatment action campaign was because of incompetent government who didn't want to do anything about HIV and AIDS. We remember Manto, we remember Tabo. They were government people.
Gareth, it's a nuanced point. Don't miss it. Here's the point.
This was not government.
Here's the point. My point is, if you have a good idea, and you want that idea to be effected, you have to stay close to the power broker. You've said... what's an example of people staying close to the power broker? I'm not making a case that there was an instance of a good idea from government. That was obviously bad policy from Thabo Mbeki. But there are instances where the people have been interested enough in the topic to stay close and stay organized to actually make sure that the politicians don't mess it up through their own incompetence.
I need to actually bounce now.
Yeah.
Next
time, if you come on time,
we'll never arrive
on time.
It was late notice for the show. In my defense, I had to make a lot of moves to be here.
No, we appreciate it. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
That was fun. The Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's every week here on cliffcentral.com. Canton, thank you very much again. Jamie, very nice to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
And you can follow Jamie on Twitter. You're one of the few people who's still on Twitter, right?
Yeah, well, Twitter is a place where the debates happen. Yeah. It's not a cesspool. You need to learn how to navigate Twitter. That's my advice for a lot
of
people.
Good luck. Wait till it happens to you. Mighty Jamie. There we go. That's where we find you, right?
Yeah, Twitter and Facebook. I'm also on Facebook.
Just you wait. I'm hoping nothing horrible happens, but that place is full of shit.
The wood? There's no wood here.
Good luck. It is 4 after 8, cliffcentral.com. Cliffcentral.com.